Chapter 6, Propaganda, Censorship, and Subversion. My purpose here is not to restate in truncated form what I wrote at length in Unfreedom of the Press. Nonetheless, some initial and limited overlap is necessary to explain how the media are now well suited as propagandists for an anti-American, pro-Marxist agenda, from critical race theory and the 1619 Project to the degrowth movement and its war on capitalism. Writing in Jacobin Magazine, a self-described socialist publication, Stephen Sherman notes that Marx was a journalist more or less all of his adult life. He started writing for the Rheinische Zeitung in 1842 and founded his own paper in 1848. His work for the New York Tribune came about because he had met an American newspaper editor, Charles Dana, who would later go on to edit the New York Sun, in Cologne in 1848. And a few years later, Dana asked Marx to contribute some articles to the New York Tribune on the situation in Germany. I think that Marx and Engels viewed the Tribune as a way to publicize their views and to influence debate with a large number of readers. In an interview with James Ledbetter, the editor of Dispatches for the New York Tribune, a 2008 book of Marx's articles for the Tribune, Ledbetter explains that the basic Marx approach to his New York Tribune column was to take an event that was in the news, an election, an uprising, the Second Opium War, the outbreak of the American Civil War, and sift through it until he could boil it down to some fundamental questions of politics or economics. And then on those questions, he would make his judgment. In this sense, Marx's journalism does resemble some of the writing that is published today in journals of opinion, and it's not hard to see a direct line between Marx's journalistic writing and the kind of tendentious writing on public affairs that characterized much political journalism, especially in Europe, in the 20th century. Thus, Marx approached journalism as modern journalists do today, that is, he was unencumbered by a commitment to actual news reporting. Instead, his reporting would shape the news around his own opinions and ideology. After 1848, Marx learned the power of counter-revolution, writes Ledbetter, and began to believe that existing systems of government and economy could not be overthrown until a relatively informed and organized proletariat could be mobilized to do so. As became clear with every passing year, in many nations, such organization was decades away, if it existed at all. In short, Marx understood the power of mass communication and the need to control it and shape it to frame events and opinions. In other words, the purpose was to propagandize, not inform. Reading through Marx's Tribune dispatches, you can't help but see an urgency, an excitement, almost an impatience in his portrayals of some insurrections and crises in Europe and India. At times, he wrote as if this particular rise in corn prices or this little dust-up with authorities in Greece was going to be the spark that would ignite revolution. And it's not as if one can fault Marx for feeling that way. After all, during this period, crowned heads of Europe were toppling, and certainly at least liberal revolutions seemed likely in a number of settings. But there are times when his discipline of thought appears to leave him, and he is also prone to the tautology that revolution can only occur when the masses are ready, but we can't know for certain if the masses are ready until they create a revolution. Ledbetter explains that Marx was indeed a revolutionary advocating his ideology of material historicism, but he was, first and foremost, a journalist. Marx today is taught as an economic theorist, as a political thinker, and to some degree as a historian and philosopher. Each category is valid, each is also incomplete. The historical record, however, at least suggests another category, that Marx should be thought of as a professional writer, as a journalist. The Penguin Classics volume I've edited is but a sample. Overall, Marx produced, with help from Engels, nearly 500 articles for the Tribune, which together amass nearly 7 volumes of the two men's 50-volume collected works. I think we come closer to understanding the importance of rhetoric in Marx's work if we think of him as a journalist. The fact is, modern journalists from the New York Times and Washington Post to CNN and MSNBC and most other news platforms have much in common with Marx the journalist, as will become evident. They have abandoned the traditional role of a reporter for that of social activist, driving most of the same major issues and agendas as the various Marxist movements in the United States. The transition did not happen overnight, but has been building for the better part of a century. Indeed, more than half a century ago, the late Richard M. Weaver, professor of English at the University of Chicago, and referenced earlier in the book, had already commented on the beginning of the end of genuine journalism in America. In his book, Ideas Have Consequences, he wrote that the modern press is actually a highly negative force in our society. He was not opposed to a free press, of course, but he was repelled by what it had become. Weaver opined, "For Plato, truth was a living thing, never wholly captured by men even in animated discourse and its purest form, certainly never brought to paper. In our day, it would seem that a contrary presumption has grown up. The more firmly an utterance is stereotyped, the more likely it is to win credit. It is assumed that engines as expensive and as powerful as the modern printing press will naturally be placed in the hands of men of knowledge. Faith in the printed word has raised journalism to the rank of oracles." Yet how could there be a better description of them than these lines from the Phaedrus? "They will appear to be omniscient and will generally know nothing. They will be tiresome, having the reputation of knowledge without the reality." If the realization of truth is the product of a meeting of minds, wrote Weaver, we may be skeptical of the physical ability of the mechanism to propagate it, as long as that propagation is limited to the printing and distribution of stories which give one unvarying answer. And this circumstance brings up at once the question of the intention of the rulers of the press. There is much to indicate that modern publication wishes to minimize discussion. Despite many artful pretensions to the contrary, it does not want an exchange of views, save perhaps on academic matters. Instead, it encourages men to read in the hope that they will absorb. In this, Weaver is condemning the nature of media as organized propaganda involving individuals who are not particularly bright or knowledgeable about the matters on which they write or speak, but are propagandists for particular viewpoints. Weaver argued that there is another circumstance which raises grave doubts about the contribution of journalism to the public weal. Newspapers are under strong pressure to distort in the interest of holding attention. It is an inescapable fact that newspapers thrive on friction and conflict. One has only to survey the headlines of some popular journal, often presented symbolically in red, to note the kind of thing which is considered news. Behind the big story, there nearly always lies a battle of some sort. Conflict, after all, is the essence of drama, and it is a truism that newspapers deliberately start and prolong quarrels by allegation, by artful quotation, by the accentuation of unimportant differences. They create antagonism where none was felt to exist before. And this is profitable practically, for the opportunity to dramatize a fight is an opportunity for news. Journalism, on the whole, is glad to see a quarrel start and sorry to see it end. In the more sensational publications, this spirit of passion and violence manifested in a certain recklessness of diction, with vivid verbs and fortissimo adjectives, creeps into the very language. By the attention it gives their misdeeds, it makes criminals heroic and politicians larger than life. I would go a step further. The press not only starts and prolongs quarrels, but thrives today on the exploitation of issues and agendas that serve the purposes of the various Marxist movements, and in doing so inflames and divides the entire nation along ideological lines. In reviewing the persistent tendency of the newspapers to corrupt, I shall cite a passage from author James Fenimore Cooper, writes Weaver. Though Cooper lived before the advent of yellow journalism, he seems to have stated the essential situation with a truth and eloquence impossible to improve on when he said in The American Democrat, "As the press of this country now exists, it would seem to be expressly devised by the great agent of mischief to depress and destroy all that is good, and to elevate and advance all that is evil in the nation." The little truth that is urged is usually urged coarsely, weakened and rendered vicious by personalities, while those who live by falsehoods, fallacies, enmities, partialities, and the schemes of the designing find the press the very instrument that the devils would invent to effect their designs. Weaver and Cooper were highlighting what would become the media's use of targeted personal attacks on individuals and subjects that defy or resist the trajectory of events and movements for which journalists have become committed and open advocates. This is seen every day with, for example, the relentless polemical characterizations of individuals and groups as climate change deniers, Trump deplorables, white supremacists, etc. Weaver observes, "The constant stream of sensation eulogized as lively propagation of what the public wants to hear discourages the pulling together of events from past time into a whole for contemplation. Thus, absence of reflection keeps the individual from being aware of his former selves, and it is highly questionable whether anyone can be a member of a metaphysical community who does not preserve such memory. Upon the presence of the past in the present depends all conduct and direct knowledge. There can be little doubt that this condition of the mind is a large factor in the low political morality of the age." Of course, the whole of Marxist thought is the cleansing of history for the purification of future existence. That is, all that came before must be rejected and destroyed by violent revolution, if necessary, to make way for the Marxist society. As will become clear, a combination of propaganda, pseudo-events, social activism, and targeted personal attacks has replaced traditional journalism. Moreover, it actively promotes the various causes and movements of the American Marxist. Edward Bernays, considered the father of modern propaganda, wrote in his 1928 book, Propaganda, that propaganda is a consistent, enduring effort to create or shape events to influence the relations of the public to an enterprise, idea, or group. So vast are the numbers of minds which can be regimented, and so tenacious are they when regimented, that a group at times offers an irresistible pressure before which legislators, editors, and teachers are helpless. Bernays explained, "The minority, including elites and activists, has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. In the present structure of society, this practice is inevitable. Whatever of social importance is done today, whether in politics, finance, manufacturing, agriculture, charity, education, or other fields, must be done with the help of propaganda. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government." Richard Gunderman at phys.org points out that what Bernays' writings furnish is not a principle or tradition by which to evaluate the appropriateness of propaganda, but simply a means for shaping public opinion for any purpose whatsoever, whether beneficial to human beings or not. This observation led Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter to warn President Franklin Roosevelt against allowing Bernays to play a leadership role in World War II, describing him and his colleagues as professional poisoners of the public mind, exploiters of foolishness, fanaticism, and self-interest. In his 1927 book, Propaganda Technique in the World War, Harold Dwight Lasswell describes propaganda as a tool used by the press and others, cloaked as learning and wisdom. Propaganda is a concession to the rationality of the modern world. A literate world, a reading world, a schooled world prefers to thrive on argument and news. It is sophisticated to the extent of using print, and he that takes to print shall live or perish by the press. All the apparatus of diffused erudition popularizes the symbols and forms of pseudo-rational appeal. The wolf of propaganda does not hesitate to masquerade in the sheepskin. All the voluble men of the day, writers, reporters, editors, preachers, lecturers, teachers, politicians, are drawn into the service of propaganda to amplify a master voice. All is conducted with the decorum and the trappings of intelligence, for this is a rational epic and demands its raw meat cooked and garnished by adroit and skillful chefs. The late political theorist Hannah Arendt wrote in her book The Origins of Totalitarianism that while it is true that the masses are obsessed by a desire to escape from reality because in their essential homelessness they can no longer bear its accidental, incomprehensible aspects, it is also true that their longing for fiction has some connection with those capacities of the human mind whose structural consistency is superior to mere occurrence. The masses' escape from reality is a verdict against the world in which they are forced to live and in which they cannot exist, since coincidence has become its supreme master and human beings need the constant transformation of chaotic and accidental conditions into a man-made pattern of relative consistency. The revolt of the masses against realism, common sense, and all the plausibilities of the world was the result of their atomization, of their loss of social status, along with which they lost the whole sector of communal relationships in whose framework common sense makes sense. In their situation of spiritual and social homelessness, a measured insight into the interdependence of the arbitrary and the planned, the accidental and the necessary, could no longer operate. Totalitarian propaganda can outrageously insult common sense only where common sense has lost its validity. Before the alternative of facing the anarchic growth and total arbitrariness of decay, or bowing down before the most rigid, fantastically fictitious consistency of an ideology, the masses probably will always choose the latter and be ready to pay for it with individual sacrifices. And this is not because they are stupid or wicked, but because in the general disaster, this escape grants them a minimum of self-respect. In other words, people in a culture or society in decline, which ceases to be a unifying and civil society, and where the just social order unravels, are highly susceptible to believing and following dangerous fictions, even if they lead to their own demise. Before they seize power and establish a world according to their doctrines, wrote Arendt, totalitarian movements conjure up a lying world of consistency which is more adequate to the needs of the human mind than reality itself, in which, through sheer imagination, uprooted masses can feel at home and are spared the never-ending shocks which real life and real experiences deal to human beings and their expectations. The force possessed by totalitarian propaganda before the movements have the power to drop iron curtains to prevent anyone's disturbing, by the slightest reality, the gruesome quiet of an entirely imaginary world lies in its ability to shut the masses off from the real world. The only signs which the real world still offers to the understanding of the unintegrated and disintegrating masses, whom every new stroke of ill luck makes more gullible, are, so to speak, its lacunae, the questions it does not care to discuss publicly or the rumors it does not dare to contradict. As I explained in Ameritopia, utopianism, which would include totalitarianism, finds a receptive audience among the society's disenchanted, disaffected, dissatisfied, and maladjusted who are unwilling or unable to assume responsibility for their own real or perceived conditions, but instead blame their surroundings, the system, and others. They are lured by the false hopes and promises of utopian transformation and the criticisms of the existing society to which their connection is tentative or non-existent. Improving the malcontent's lot becomes linked to the utopian cause. Moreover, disparaging and diminishing the successful and accomplished becomes an essential tactic. By exploiting human frailties, frustrations, jealousies, and inequities, a sense of meaning and self-worth is created in the malcontent's otherwise unhappy and directionless life. Simply put, equality in misery, that is, equality of result or conformity, is advanced as a just, fair, and virtuous undertaking. Liberty, therefore, is inherently immoral except where it avails equality. in addition to propaganda, or perhaps a form of propaganda, is what the late Daniel J. Boorstin, a librarian of the United States Congress and professor of history at the University of Chicago, labeled pseudo-events, that is, staged press events. Boorstin explained, "In a totalitarian society where people are flooded by purposeful lies, the real facts are, of course, misrepresented, but the representation itself is not ambiguous. The propaganda lie is asserted as if it were true. Its object is to lead people to believe that the truth is simpler, more intelligible than it really is. Propaganda oversimplifies experience. Pseudo-events overcomplicate it." Boorstin notices how the media cleverly use pseudo-events to promote causes and agendas. He explained that, at first, it may seem strange that the rise of pseudo-events has coincided with the growth of the professional ethic, which obliges newsmen to omit editorializing and personal judgments from their news accounts. But now it is in the making of pseudo-events that newsmen find ample scope for their individuality and creative imagination. Indeed, we are inundated by pseudo-events rather than actual news, that is, an unreality of the journalist's making. For example, for literally several years, our nation was fed relentless news stories about President Donald Trump's having colluded with Russia to win his election in 2016. This spurred congressional hearings, a criminal investigation, and endless stories piled upon endless stories. Pulitzer Prizes were awarded for utterly false news reports. It was perhaps the greatest media hoax in journalistic history. As Boorstin observes, in a democratic society like ours, and more especially in a highly literate, wealthy, competitive, and technologically advanced society, the people can be flooded by pseudo-events. For us, freedom of speech and the press and of broadcasting includes freedom to create pseudo-events. Competing politicians, competing newsmen, and competing news media contest in this creation. They vie with one another in offering attractive, informative accounts and images of the world. They are free to speculate on the facts, to bring new facts into being, to demand answers to their own contrived questions. Our free marketplace of ideas is a place where people are confronted by competing pseudo-events and are allowed to judge among them. When we speak of informing the people, this is what we really mean. Thus, we seem to live in two worlds simultaneously, the fictional world that the media have created for us, and the real world of our daily existence that has little or no relationship to pseudo-events. Yet for many, the former can be alluring. "The American citizen," wrote Boorstin, "thus lives in a world where fantasy is more real than reality, where the image has more dignity than its original. We hardly dare face our bewilderment because our ambiguous experience is so pleasantly iridescent, and the solace of belief in contrived reality is so thoroughly real. We have become eager accessories to the great hoaxes of the age. These are the hoaxes we play on ourselves." The repetition, force, and pervasiveness of pseudo-events create a seductive appeal, making it more difficult to discern news and real events from the concocted. And the fake often becomes more appealing than the factual. Pseudo-events, from their very nature, tend to be more interesting and more attractive than spontaneous events. Therefore, in American public life today, pseudo-events tend to drive all other kinds of events out of our consciousness, or at least to overshadow them. Earnest, well-informed citizens seldom notice that their experience of spontaneous events is buried by pseudo-events. Yet nowadays, the more industriously they work at informing themselves, the more this tends to be true. In fact, pseudo-events, like propaganda, which are intended to deceive, control, and direct the people, are critical to promoting Marxist and totalitarian movements. Conversely, they are thoroughly destructive of a free, open, and democratic society. Boorstin explains that in 19th century America, the most extreme modernism held that man was made by his environment. In 20th century America, without abandoning belief that we are made by our environment, we also believe our environment can be made almost wholly by us. But to what end? How surprising if men who make their environment and fill experience with whatever they please could not also make their God. More recently, journalism professors and others have invented another rationale for insinuating social activism into reporting. They call it public or community journalism. As with American Marxism generally, and education in particular, the social activist journalists who now populate the vast majority of America's newsrooms are John Dewey followers. Most of them consciously, some of them unknowingly. Some among them openly admit it, others pretend otherwise. Among other things, Dewey asserted, "When I say that the first object of a renascent liberalism is education, I mean that its task is to aid in producing habits of mind and character, the intellectual and moral patterns that are somewhere near even with the actual movements of events. It is, I repeat, the split between the latter as they have externally occurred and the ways of desiring, thinking, and of putting emotion and purpose into execution that is the basic cause of present confusion in mind and paralysis in action. The educational task cannot be accomplished merely by working upon men's minds without action that affects actual change in situations. The idea that dispositions and attitudes can be altered by merely moral means, conceived of as something that goes on wholly inside of persons, is itself one of the old patterns that has to be changed. Thought, desire, and purpose exist in a constant give and take of interaction with environing conditions. But resolute thought is the first step in that change of action that will itself carry further the needed change in patterns of mind and character." Thus, Dewey argues that the habit of the mind and certain ways of thinking combined with social activism must be indoctrinated into the public psyche. In other words, the public must be indoctrinated with the social activist mindset. Dewey continued, "In short, liberalism must now become radical, meaning by radical perception of the necessity of thoroughgoing changes in the setup of institutions and corresponding activity to bring the changes to pass. For the gulf between what the actual situation makes possible and the actual state itself is so great that it cannot be bridged by piecemeal policies undertaken ad hoc. If radicalism be defined as perception of need for radical change, then today any liberalism which is not also radicalism is irrelevant and doomed. Hence, radical steps must be taken if and as necessary to drive ideological ambitions into action throughout society. No half measures or half steps." As Dewey clearly knew, Marx was also intolerant of half-measures. He condemned socialism as a bastardization of his ideology, making the workers' paradise an impossibility. And this is what animates and motivates the Dewey adherents in the press, which now accounts for most newsrooms. Michael Shudson, professor at University of California, San Diego, writes, "Public journalism, like reforms of the progressive era, advances an unresolved blend of empowering the people and entrusting elites and experts with public responsibility. The progressives supported both the initiative and the referendum, which gave power to the people, and city manager government, which shifted power to professionals. The progressives praised both direct primaries giving power to the people and a merit-based civil service giving power to the educationally qualified. What all these reforms, both populist and elitist, shared was antipathy to political parties and to conventional partisanship. They also shared something like public journalism's ethical emphasis on proceduralism. Advocate democracy without advocating particular policy solutions." Yet journalists assure us that such an approach is not about taking political sides or ideological positions, but problem-solving and serving the community. This is nonsense. For example, in a 2016 article for Stanford Magazine, Theodore L. Glasser, professor of communications at Stanford University, reveals himself. He writes in part, In his remarkably provocative commencement address, documentarian Ken Burns called on members of the Stanford class of 2016 to put aside their political differences and work together to defeat Donald Trump. Without mentioning him by name, Burns portrayed Trump as unequivocally unqualified for the presidency. In an indictment we might expect from the leftist filmmaker Michael Moore, the politically mainstream Burns dismissed Trump as an infantile bullying man, a person who easily lies, a candidate who has never demonstrated any interest in anyone or anything but himself and his own enrichment. While Burns said he has for decades diligently practiced and rigorously maintained a conscious neutrality in his work, avoiding the advocacy of many of his colleagues, he now believes that there comes a time when I and you can no longer remain neutral, silent. We must speak up and speak out. Burns singled out journalists, torn between a nagging responsibility to good journalism and the big ratings a media circus always delivers, for failing to expose this charlatan. Glasser, writing approvingly, states, "But does Burns really want journalists to speak up and speak out, to abandon, at least in their dealings with Trump, their commitment to neutrality? Is he rejecting the ideal of the detached and disinterested reporter? Does he envision a press no longer steeped in the virtues of impartiality and objectivity? Does he plan to produce his own account of Trump the charlatan, something akin to the work of legendary CBS documentarian Edward R. Murrow, whom he mentioned approvingly? Something, say, in the spirit of Murrow's expose of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, the charlatan of the 1950s. Yes, I hope, to all of the above." And Glasser is hardly alone in this deceit. Davis Merritt, author of Public Journalism and Public Life, declares, "Because we are unavoidably participants and because our profession is dependent on democracy's continuing success, we need to develop a working philosophy of participation in helping public life go well. I call it the fair-minded participant. Adopting that philosophy does not mean abandoning good judgment, fairness, balance, accuracy, or truth. It does, however, mean employing those virtues on the field of play, not from the far-removed press box, not as a contestant, but as a fair-minded participant whose presence is necessary in order for outcomes to be determined fairly, that is, under the agreed-on rules, by the contestants. The tradition that says journalists should not deal in the realm of values creates yet another disconnect between us and our product and citizens at large." And how does Merritt's fair-minded participation play out on the pages of his newspaper? Here is an example where on December 8, 2015, writing for his Kansas newspaper, Merritt proclaimed, "Donald Trump has not received a single vote and has zero delegates to the Republican National Convention, so time remains to head off what theoretically could be a candidate disaster for the GOP and a governing disaster for America. But that's a lot less time than the nation had in August when his bizarre presidential campaign took wings out of a huge, raucous rally in Mobile, Alabama." Of course, Trump would go on to win the presidency. But again, Merritt is a partisan whose idea of public journalism is the promotion of his ideological bias. Indeed, he makes no bones about his hatred for Trump. The persistence of Trump's reckless, bullying, superficial, no apologies, often truth-free campaign has mainline Republicans terrified. To most of them, a candidate as radical as Trump would surely result in the loss of another presidential race, see Barry Goldwater and George McGovern, and likely the loss of the Senate. Merritt admonishes that objective or impartial reporting, or at least its pursuit, is too sterile for the public journalism crowd. In truth, their view of improving democracy and solving community problems is in fact more about the promotion of their political agenda. Nonetheless, Merritt and his colleagues self-servingly insist on the openness and earnestness of their approach. In fact, they seem to view themselves self-righteously as good Samaritans. "My primary purpose is not to try to describe or encourage a particular device or set of practices," explains Merritt. "To do so would in itself limit the possibilities. My objective is to stimulate thoughtful, serious discussion both inside and outside the profession about journalism's true place in democracy. The aim is not to provide, even if I could, immediate and specific answers. Journalism and public life did not reach their points of present decline quickly, and they will not recover quickly. Those specific answers will have to be found over time and through earnest experimentation.